Greetings, Applied AI podcast listeners. This is Justin Grammons, your host of the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. Just dropping in to let you know about a very special event we have coming up on Friday, May 12th. It's the Spring 2023 Applied AI Conference. You can learn more by going to appliedaiconf.com. This full-day, in-person conference is the only and largest artificial intelligence conference held in the Upper Midwest. It will be in Minneapolis, Minnesota on May 12th. We will have more than 20 speakers with two tracks covering everything from AI business applications, ChatGPT, computer vision, machine learning, and so much more. For being a listener to this podcast, use the promo code PODCAST when purchasing your ticket for a 50% discount. So here's the details. Go to appliedaiconf.com, that's appliedaiconf.com, to see the full schedule and register for the only and largest artificial intelligence conference in the Upper Midwest on May 12th. And don't forget to use a promo code of PODCAST when checking out to receive a 50% discount. We look forward to seeing you there, and thank you so much for listening. And now, on with this episode.
That's kind of why NLP's exploded, is because of these embeddings, which basically give numerical representations of the words. That's how these models are able to learn so much and able to complete such complex tasks, is because they learn from numerical representations of the words. From a super high level, it feels like it's very, if you just looked at the surface, it feels like you just said, numbers versus words. It's like the complete opposite. It's really not at all. And if you're training a simple NLP model, it is literally like training a machine learning model, just with words, not numbers. And if you really boil down the brass tacks of what's going on under the hood, it is more basic data science than you, because of these embeddings basically. Yeah, make the words into numerical representations, and then you can use traditional data science to make predictions on things.
Welcome to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast, where Justin Grammons and the team at Emerging Technologies North talk with experts in the fields of artificial intelligence and deep learning. In each episode, we cut through the hype and dive into how these technologies are being applied to real-world problems today. We hope that you find this episode educational and applicable to your industry, and connect with us to learn more about our organization at appliedai.mn. Enjoy.
Welcome, everyone, to the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. Today, we're speaking with Eric Olson. Eric is the co-founder and CEO at Consensus, a search engine that uses AI to surface expert answers. Prior to Consensus, he worked at DraftKings Analytics, where he built cool models and created new metrics to better understand their users. In 2017, he graduated with a Master's of Science in Predictive Analytics from Northwestern University, was a three-year starter for the Northwestern University football team, and a four-time academic All-Big Ten honoree. Quite an accomplishment, Eric. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I usually start out with my guests talking a little bit about, you know, how they got into the field and what their background was and all that sort of like technical stuff. But I'm actually really curious to start out maybe sharing more about your football experience. What position did you play, and how do you think maybe that might have shaped to where you got to where you are today?
So my whole football journey, I kind of came about in a roundabout way. I was a basketball player my whole life, and I actually transferred to a private school in high school to try to get recruited for basketball, and was convinced that it would help my chances of getting into the school if I said I'd also try out football. And as it turns out, I'm about 6'6" and not, you know, crazy athlete or anything. And somebody with that body type and athleticism makes for a really, really great offensive tackle, but not a great collegiate center for basketball. So I ended up getting a bunch of scholarship offers for football, chose to go to Northwestern, and wanted to find a place that married academics and athletics. I played offensive line. I was their starting right tackle for 3 years. And I'd say, well, one, I come from a family of a bunch of academics. So I've always been interested in science and the world of science. But in my fifth year, I started to dive into data science. I got my master's in predictive analytics. And that's kind of how I started down this road that eventually ended in Consensus. But I'd say, as far as, you know, there's a lot of lessons to learn from playing high level football, high level athletics in an entrepreneurial journey. And I'd say, above all, what football taught me that kind of led me to take the leap into entrepreneurship is realizing that imposter syndrome are just fake thoughts in your own head. And football really faces you to confront those. And you realize, you know, you're on a stage of something you've always dreamed of and playing in front of hundreds of thousands of people. But those same thoughts of, do I belong here, are still in your head. And when you kind of have that moment, you realize everyone thinks this. It really teaches you to push past that and realize that it's just the self-conscious part of your mind talking to you. And that is something that happens a lot when you start a company of, what am I doing? And should I be doing this? Am I the person to do this? And oftentimes those are very unhelpful thoughts, and high level athletics definitely teach you to push past those.
Nice. Well, keeping with the metaphor, I mean, at least in athletics, you oftentimes have a coach or a trainer or somebody with you. This is sort of off the cuff, but like, you know, when you're getting into business and you started your business, did you have anybody like that?
Certainly. Yeah. I'd say two main buckets. One, former bosses of mine. Before I worked for 3 or 4 years before I started the company. And, you know, a few of my former bosses are now investors in my company and meet with them regularly and get advice from them. That's more on like the managerial side and, you know, balancing employees and emotional stuff. And then there's another bucket of other founders. Going to a school like Northwestern, I'm certainly lucky to have been surrounded by a good entrepreneurial network of people that I was peers with in college who have also started their own companies before I did. And we have leaned extremely heavily on those people on navigating this crazy world. And yeah, I think you're spot on. My co-founder also is a Northwestern football player. I really mean it when I say I think one of our biggest strengths of a company is taking advice from those types of people and taking it seriously and seeking out advice and coaching. And I think our athletics background definitely has informed that to an extent. We feel like we're coachable, feel like we can take hard advice and not get too sensitive and make better decisions from that. And I think it's been a real strength of ours. And I think you're totally right to call out that connection.
Excellent. You mentioned growing up with a family of academics. I mean, my dad was a physician, my mom was a school teacher, but they did start their own business. They started a vending business actually for stamp machines. And so I remember being young and going around with them to put new stamps in the stamp machine and getting the quarters out, what people bought. And this was back in the days when there wasn't any email, right? So everyone was sending stuff and everyone needed stamps. So they'd go down to the local store and sort of like buy stamps. And, you know, I never really thought that I would become an entrepreneur either. You mentioned your parents having academic background. Did you see anything? Did you see any entrepreneurial stuff as you were growing up?
Honestly, not too much, if I'm being totally honest. I really mean it when I say my family has a pretty deep academic background. My grandfather is a lifelong professor, my dad's dad. My parents actually met at an MIT lab after college. My dad was a computer scientist doing research at MIT, and my mom was a cartographer. So not deep into academia, but they're both working at a research lab in the Boston area. And then my sister is a lifelong teacher. She's done nothing but teach her whole career. She's taught all over the world and has an advanced degree in education. And honestly, what really pushed me to taking the entrepreneurial leap was not familial backgrounds. It was the why now story that I felt like emerged from this idea that I had. As a non-expert, as somebody who, you know, is kind of a jock who wants to be a scientist deep down because of those familial connections, I yearned for a product that made it easy to get good information quickly and get information from academic sources. And I knew that product didn't exist. And it was really in the middle of COVID, two things happened. One, it was never more clear that the world really wanted a product like that there was a demand for getting good verified information quickly, but then also learning about how far along AI had come specifically in language model technology and realizing this idea that I had 6-7 years ago, holy crap, it might actually be able to be solved, and it might actually be able to be solved as of like a year ago. And basically had the conversation with my co-founder, if we don't do this, somebody else is going to. And felt like that was such a, I felt this pull from that why now story more so than from, you know, having a deep history in my family of entrepreneurship.
Gotcha. So sort of, yeah, I get it. In some ways, sort of scratching your own itch, I guess. You're seeing a need in the market. This is something you would use on a day-to-day basis.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so I was just going to say, maybe rewind me back. You're sitting there at DraftKings, or I think, right? Is that where you left to then start this business? You see this opportunity. Tell me a little bit about the company, I guess. What does it do? And how was it when you finally pulled the trigger?
Our company is called Consensus, and we are a new search engine that uses artificial intelligence to find answers in peer-reviewed papers. So it allows you to type in a plain English question, does fish oil actually help cardiovascular conditions? And then what the engine will do is find papers that have looked to answer that question and pull out the claims being made from those papers. So effectively, it's a way to have a question and instantly see what the landscape of evidence in research is about that question. Are COVID vaccines effective? Does zinc actually help with depression? Does the death penalty actually reduce crime? all questions that have been empirically studied, you can ask, and we'll find the conclusions that have been made in research about. And yeah, I think you said it exactly right. You know, one of our big advantages is we're really building a product that serves ourselves and we're our first users. I use the product every week, not in a professional, obviously I'm doing tests and whatnot, but I use it to look up my own questions every single week. And it came from a frustration of knowing many of the things that we debate with our friends, with our family, or just personally, that there are people who have dedicated their lives to studying those questions empirically. But that data is completely inaccessible, especially for a layperson. And you basically have two options to quickly search for that type of thing. You type it into Google. It's great for many things, but it's not designed to answer these questions. You're getting clickbaity headlines to blogs that are SEO and you get a bunch of advertisements too. Or you could pop open a Google Scholar or a PubMed, which has the right source material, the same source material we're using. But those products haven't innovated in a decade. All they allow for is keyword hacking, and they deliver you a list of links, and all your work is still at it. So we wanted to try to build a product that took the best of both worlds, that took the intuitive ease of use of a consumer product like Google, but married that with the rigorous source material like traditional academic source search engines. And yeah, loved working at DraftKings. It was an amazing place to work. Did a lot of cool things there. Completely unrelated subject matter-wise, but it really was in the middle of the pandemic where I was no longer commuting and had some extra time at the end of the day. Also sports had stopped, so the DraftKings workload was a little bit lighter than normal. So had a little bit of time to explore some other ideas and potential pursuits. And it was that led me to start working on it along the side and made some progress and realized we were kind of onto something, had some people that wanted to invest money in it. And when you kind of get, it isn't the sexiest, oh, I dropped everything and took this giant risk. We actually had some investors lined up by the time that I had quit my job. Wasn't the proverbial giant leap of faith. It was clear we were kind of onto something. And I used the luxury of working from home.
So is this you and your co-founder getting this thing started? Or did you have, how many people are sort of were involved in the early days?
It was me and my co-founder who spent a few months just defining what we were trying to do and learning about how we could potentially do it, learning about natural language processing and artificial intelligence. But then we brought on a contracted data scientist to help us build a proof of concept. His name is Ali Farid. He's a PhD in computer science, and he is now on the team full time. We brought him on to just build us something to prove to ourselves that it could work and eventually prove to investors that it could work to then raise money to build the scalable version of it. He did so quickly and so efficiently that we knew he had to be a part of the team. So we asked him to come on full time as our founding engineer. And then after we quit our jobs and raised a little bit of money, we hired two more engineers and now have a full time team of five.
Yeah, cool. And you guys are sort of all over the United States?
Yeah, me and my co-founder are here in Boston together and the rest of the team is totally distributed.
Cool. These are exciting times. It's kind of fun that I guess to be able to sort of see the product kind of get traction that quickly, especially throughout the investor community, right? You guys were able to put together a sort of an MVP and people came to you, I guess, in some ways, and you didn't have to sell them or do a very hard sell, it sounds like.
I'm underselling it a bit. It definitely took a lot of conversations and we definitely were reaching out to some folks as well. So I'm simplifying it for the sake of the story. It wasn't, I just popped open my computer and I had people standing at the door wanting it. Not quite that. But
yeah.
2021 was an advantageous fundraising time, I should say.
Sure, sure. Well, you feel like you're onto something if it's more of a, if people are getting pulled into it rather than to sort of push them into it.
It makes it very real quickly.
Yeah. And you were talking about source material. I guess, I don't really know, is this material completely and freely available? You guys have to pay to get any of it or is it able to be accessed by anybody?
So our data is in our product through a partnership we have with the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. They typically work with mostly other nonprofit research organizations. They are a nonprofit research organization themselves. Through some relationship building and conversations, we were able to work out a partnership because we were able to show them how mission aligned we were and that we were trying to do, had similar objectives that they had, just with a slightly different slant to it. And we're lucky enough to get that partnership and get access to about 200 million papers via. Now, within that data set, a large portion of it is fully open access. They have just aggregated it. However, there are some within there that are still behind paywalls. We're able to run our analysis and surface those to you. But if you follow the links, the full text of the paper, you still would be subject to those paywalls. However, gotcha. The trend is very much in our favor, and there was legislation passed this year that all federally funded research has to be fully open access by 2025, meaning more and more of these documents will be able to be accessed by anybody. And we hope to be the layer that helps you access those papers more easily.
Sure. So it's safe to say you guys are bringing more of a conversational approach to this, or using conversational AI to ask these questions?
So Very much yes, in the sense that our AI allows for natural language questions. So like you don't have to just keyword hack like you would if you use Google Scholar. Like you can say literally, what is your research question? You can just ask it. Does the death penalty reduce crime? You can ask that question like that, and we'll find you claims made in papers about the question. Where I pump the brakes a little bit on using the word conversational AI is that our results are actually extractive from the papers. So unlike something like ChatGPT, we're not generating text out of thin air. It's not our models answering the question for you. It's our models looking through a paper and trying to find you the answer. So we're actually surfacing you word for word quotes from papers about your question, as opposed to conversationally generating text and answer the question. And we, you know, ChatGPT is amazing, and we want to use some generative tech in the product. But for our purposes, pretty important to understand the source material. A conversational AI is amazing for some use cases, but in what we're trying to do and deliver you research-backed answers and insights, it's pretty important to know the source material.
Yeah, for sure. Can you string questions together? Can you build on questions? Once you get an answer, then sort of, is it smart enough to understand that I'm still asking questions along the same way? Along a thread, I guess.
Yeah. We do not have any advanced functionality like that right now. That is definitely something we're working on and thinking about in the background. But right now it is not query to query, taking in what you just clicked on or something from the last session.
Who's your core customer, I guess? You know, I was just thinking about, I've heard something similar in regards to people that have looked through all sorts of patents. And so like lawyers are using a lot of their stuff to find patent material or other stuff that's been infringed upon. Where do you guys find most of your customers? Like which area of the industry?
Yeah, so there's really kind of two ends of the spectrum. And it's pretty cool because they're in many ways opposite of the spectrum and where we see most of our users. So you have this one bucket that is kind of like myself and my co-founder. Evidence interested non-experts. The sub-persona within that we see the most is health and fitness optimizers. So the type of people who are looking up information on supplements, on exercise routines, on sleep routines, and constantly on the hunt for the best information to optimize all parts of their health. We see a lot of people using the product for that reason. Probably how I use the product the most when I hear some friend make a claim about some miracle supplement or something. It represents a way to quickly fact check it and understand that there's actually research about that. But then you have the other end of the spectrum, which are people who are using it for more deeper research tasks. The core use case there is students, tons and tons of students using the product. And you think about it in the sense of, I'm writing a paper, I have my hypothesis. Now, instead of just trying to hack together keywords and find papers and dig into them for the bits of information you're looking for to include in your paper, you can actually just type in your research question in ConsenSys and we'll deliver you back the insights about that question. So you can much more quickly get yourself to a point where it's, hey, this is what I want to include. This is what backs up my argument. Or maybe changes your argument because you realize that the weight of evidence is, you know, on the other side. But those are really the two, which is cool because it's the kind of both ends of the spectrum where you have your more like consumer use case and then you have people using it in a real academic setting.
I love it. How do you see this changing then the future of paper writing for students, I guess, right? They're going to be more just fact-checked by their peer nature, right? Not as much hypothetical.
You hear a lot of people thinking about the future of paper writing because of generative AI products.
Yes.
Ours is kind of, it's a tool that doesn't potentially like take, I'm saying this poorly, but because it's not generative, ours represents just like a research tool alongside what you're doing as opposed to in speeding up your work, as opposed to doing the work for you. And I think that is why we've been looked at more favorably by the academic community. We have some partnerships with libraries. We have libraries reaching out to us to be a part of the school's evidence tools that allow students to better get information. So like a generative tool, if you tell it to write you a paper, it will write you a paper. How good it is, still up in the air. And I think that is what is really scaring a lot of people of all is just, you know, are these tools going to basically just do the work for students? Whereas we kind of sit on a different side of the spectrum where it's, we can speed up your process. We can quicker get you to the information you're looking for, and hopefully good information, but we're not actually doing the work for it. we're not generating you a payment. So ours is more of a tool to make you more efficient, not do the work for you, which I know is scaring a lot of people in academia now with these generative products.
For sure. What do you guys see the future of consensus being and sort of the work that you're doing in the next 3 to 5 years or so? I mean, are there breakthroughs coming in? I mean, you know, NLP is just getting better and better. Are you guys looking at different languages, translation maybe? Maybe there's papers were written in a different language you could bring in. I guess I'm spitballing ideas here. So I'm just curious to see where you guys see the industry going.
Yeah. I mean, we get requests for new languages all the time. So it's definitely something we want to incorporate. But really there's in the short to medium term, like the 1 to 1.5 to 2 year time period, there are two main features that we are working toward and we want to be releasing soon, which are using some of these generative products or generative tools to synthesize answers across papers. Now, we want to be careful. We want to make sure that they're used with guardrails where we can say, all right, here are the top 20 results. Here's a summary of those 20 results. But here are the results that populate that summary or that were used to generate that summary are right here, so you can cross-reference. So we want to be able to do some automatic synthesis for you, but we want to do it tied to source material where we're not just creating it out of thin. So we'll kind of call this whole bucket of automated synthesis across papers. And then the other bucket is evidence scoring. So using these AI tools to extract other information from the papers to help us understand, is this quality research or not? So it's, you know, extracting things like, what was the sample size? What type of study was it? Who funded this study? What was the effect size of the outcome? These are all things that you can train models like a human expert would to read through a paper and pick out and analyze. Eventually, what we want to get to is extracting all of those things to have that roll up to some sort of evidence confidence score tied to each one of those claims. And then if you can picture, we have a synthesis part of the product, but we already have the underlying claims that are being used to generate that synthesis now have scores to them. We can do a really robust, cool, automated evidence synthesis to your question. Hey, we looked across 20 papers, 13 say this, 5 say this, 2 say this. Here's the scores of each one of those schools of thought. Effectively, it all boils down to, if you were an expert and you had infinite time, how would you assess what the answer to a research question is across the literature? You'd find the relevant papers, you'd pull out the key points of the paper, and you'd assess the quality of those papers. We want to automate that entire process. And then the five-year vision is incorporate other types of data sources. Our lane is using AI to surface expert answers. We're starting with scientific research. It makes a million reasons why we think that makes sense, but there are other giant text documents that have expert insights within them. And we'd love to incorporate other types of data sets to the product and build an easy-to-use AI-powered search product over top.
That's cool. Really good. You seeing anything interesting in sort of this random off the cuff question, but you know, you're looking at virtual reality or, you know, augmented reality or any of that type of stuff to interact with your product?
Can't say that we have. I think that the future of our product is using more of these language model tools that are continuing to get better and better. I don't know if we're the type of product that will dip its toe in the metaverse or anything like that. Maybe we'll see. Yeah. Maybe we'll all be in the metaverse in 5 years and we'll be forced to worry, to think about that and how to incorporate it. But can't say we haven't really thought much about it yet.
I was thinking when you're talking about becoming the best researcher or, you know, asking a question, some people have maybe put a name to their product, you know, or a persona or a person around it. And then, you know, it really feels like it's somebody that you're interacting with. So I wasn't sure if you guys were thinking about that or maybe go there in 5 years.
That is actually fair because we have talked about some things like that. You know, talking to ChatGPT is like talking to the average of the internet right now. And our goal, if we did build like an interactive chat feature, would be have it like talking to your scientist friend. And then, you know, if we ever built out that module that was purely conversational yet, we'd probably give it some, call it Einstein or something.
Yeah, sure. Did you go right into a master's program to do this predictive analytics?
Yes. My academic background before that was like traditional, like, business type degree. And it was not the easiest, but I had to teach myself how to code and kind of went right into the trial by fire right into that program.
Would you recommend it?
I mean, there's definitely better on-ramps if you dip your toe in computer science or data science and in undergraduate work, but you know, there's no trial by fire is definitely an effective way to learn in many ways of forcing yourself, you know, forcing function to actually learn a specific type of skill. And when I took my job at DraftKings, there was still a lot that I didn't know. I was still relatively new to the space. And if I had, you know, said, I can't take this because there's certain skills that I don't know yet, I would have never been where I am today. And learning on the job, you know, having the skills to figure things out on the job is arguably the most important skill of all. Is you get more skills if you have the skill of figuring things out and learning more skills.
For sure. Yeah. So anyone that's maybe coming out of school, I guess undergraduate or master's, like how are you guys hiring? And I'm sure you're looking for certain skill sets, you know, number one. And then, like I say, maybe put yourself in that graduate student's shoes.
Yeah.
What should they be learning?
We're not hiring at the moment. We probably will be soon. We're going to be looking for some more traditional software engineers first. I can speak to the route that I took and why it helped get into the AI world, but there's a million different ways. And it's one of the beauties of the world today is that there's so much information available that you can teach yourself a lot of these things. And there's online resources. You know, there's really no excuse to get yourself up to a point of some competency if you really want it. But I think the on-ramp for me was learning about data science and predictive analytics. It feels like it's extremely far away from artificial intelligence. At the end of the day, they're more similar than they are different. And it is still the same process of, you know, giving inputs and making predictions on outputs. It is still a bunch of X variables trying to spit out a Y variable. That's obviously simplified, but that understanding that art and science, a easiest on-ramp to doing that is understanding it from just a pure data science perspective first. And then you can apply so many of those same learning to more advanced artificial intelligence. And that's really how I learned to do it. And that's really why I felt qualified to lead this team. And so many of those learnings, even though it's simpler, quote unquote, problems that I was working on in DraftKings, like traditional machine learning modeling, those skills of how to piece together a model, how to train a model, what matters are so applicable even when you get to much more complex problems. So my advice overall would be a great on-ramp is learning about the basics of data science and machine learning first and using that to propel yourself into more advanced worlds.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, as you were talking there, I was thinking about, you know, most people, it feels very foreign to be working in data science and numbers, and then to have natural language processing, which is all words, right? And I think a lot of people don't really see the connection or like how it applies.
Well, yeah, well, that's kind of why NLP has exploded, is because of these embeddings, which basically give numerical representations of the numbers, of the words. That's how these models are able to learn so much and able to complete such complex tasks, is because they learn from numerical representations of the words. So while it, from a super high level, it feels like it's very, if you just looked at the surface, it feels like you just said, numbers versus words. It's like the complete opposite. It's really not at all. And if you're training a simple NLP model, it is literally like training a machine learning model, just with words, not numbers. And if you really boil down the brass tacks of what's going on under the hood, it is more basic data science than you, because of these embeddings basically. Yeah, make the words into numerical representations, and then you can use traditional data science to make predictions on things.
Is that fair to say then that's sort of the aha moment or the epiphany that you saw a couple of years ago in this thing?
It's a part of it, but the real epiphany was these transformer models, which take out those embeddings and apply a type of learning that has allowed them to understand the context of language to a degree that was never possible before. So there's a really famous paper called Attention is All You Need. And it was a paper by Google engineers as they released their first transformer model called BERT. And we still use a BERT-based model today. I'm going to screw it up. I'm not a full-blown expert on every part of the specifics of it, but it boils down to a way of teaching the models to learn language where it takes in the entire block of text to make a prediction on a specific part of text and repeat that pattern for it to learn about language and understand the context of language. So it's basically like saying, if you give it enough things to pay attention to, it can, and it completely transformed, no pun intended, how powerful that these NLP models were. And I believe that paper was either 2017 or 2018. And that's when it really started to take off. And it's that same basic framework that GPT is trained on, where basically is given a giant brick of text. And then there are words that are masked. And you teach it by having to try to predict what words are missing. And then you tell it where it was wrong, and you give that a billion examples. And then all of a sudden it learns how language functions and it can talk to you almost like a human can. That technique it was bi-directional and codeine representative. I forget, bird stance or something, but that was invented back in 2017 from a foundational paper called Attention is All You Need.
Awesome. Yeah, we definitely will put a link to that in the liner notes for this episode for sure. That's awesome. Yeah, and Google seems to have really been one of the major companies that have been sort of pushing forward on this.
Yeah, I mean, that is the basics of their main product. Like a search product is inherently an NLP product, and they've been at the head of that game for a while, but that has changed in the last year that OpenAI would now be probably likely referred to as the real leader in the space. Now, there are rumblings that Google has something behind the curtain that is even better than ChatGPT. That's just rumors. I have no inside information there. That is yet to be released. That was, if you remember, like 6 or 7 months ago when it went viral, where there was a Google engineer and saying they'd created a sentient AI. What he was referring to was an unreleased chatbot model that effectively would be a rival to ChatGPT. It is yet to be released. I don't know if they've seen something that terrifies them or something, but they are working on working on things under the surface. But OpenAI has really been the recent leader in this space. And what's cool about what they do is that they're not building products like Google. They're building foundational models to then be used by companies like us. So it's a pretty, the incentives are completely set up in the right way for innovation there, where all they're trying to do is push the space forward, not, hog all the resources and the models to themselves.
Sure. That's good. Well, people can go to Consensus and, sign up for free, right? And, or at least there's a limited trial. Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yeah. So consensus.app is how you'd access it. It is totally free for now. In early 2023, we are going to be releasing a premium tier with some of these features that we talked about. There will be a small subscription fee per month. And then, depending on a myriad of things, we may have some usage-based subscription as well. But right now we're trying to, we want to keep a portion of the product always free, both selfishly and altruistically. We want it selfishly because it's a great growth engine. It's a great way to get people into the product and learning about us and discovering us and eventually hopefully converting to paid. But also, we think it's an important product and we want to be able to give some value to people regardless if they're able to pay or, need it every day like some people will and some people won't. And we want to have the ability to access it for free. So right now, totally free to sign up and search. In the future, there will be a premium offering both with features and potentially some users.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, great. How do people get a hold of you, Eric?
Yeah.
LinkedIn?
LinkedIn, Eric Olson, OLSON. You can go on Twitter and follow us at ConsensusNLP. I'm on that Twitter all the time. If you DMs are open, if you want to contact us. And then, yeah, those are probably the two best ways, LinkedIn or Twitter.
That's good. That's good. Well, curious, just to sort of end it off here as we start like winding down, you still play sports, football, basketball, any of those things?
Basketball. Football is a bit harder to play recreationally. And I don't know if my body would be too happy with me if I tried to strap on the pads again, but I play basketball all the time.
Yeah, good. Good. Yeah, I mean, have you found exercise and physical movement helps with your mental attitude, I guess, with regards to running a business and everything?
1,000,000%. You can look up that question in Consensus and see all the amazing research on the benefits of exercise on decision-making and cognition. But yeah, there is no better remedy to getting stressed about work than going for a run or playing a game of pickup basketball. And my co-founder, like I said, is also a former athlete. And we definitely, you will never be faulted if you sign off for a few hours to go exercise. Because, not only do I want myself and employees to be doing well mentally, completely selfishly, but from a business perspective, you're likely, if you just work straight for 12 hours versus work for 10 hours and exercise for 1.5, you'll probably be more effective doing the latter.
Well, good, good. Okay, Eric. Well, I appreciate the time today and look forward to keeping in touch, watching what's going on with Consensus. The product is fascinating to me. I think you guys have touched on something in a unique way. And I think, like you said, your differentiator is really going to be in this space of making it easy to use, more of a consumer-based application.
That is exactly right. That is our goal with all of this. Make it easy to get hard, good information.
Well, great, Eric. Well, you take care and thanks again. And we'll definitely keep in touch. Good luck at Consensus.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me.
You've listened to another episode of the Conversations on Applied AI podcast. We hope you are eager to learn more about applying artificial intelligence and deep learning within your organization. You can visit us at appliedai.mn to keep up to date on our events and connect with our amazing community. Please don't hesitate to reach out to Justin at appliedai.mn if you are interested in participating in a future episode. Thank you for listening.